Bet, which is hosting this lecture today, and that's the Cultivating Change Through Global and Sustainable Education Network that we've set up. It's located in the Faculty of Education and Psychology, but absolutely everybody is welcome to participate in all the themes that we have surrounding global and sustainable education. We've mentioned it many times before, but you can find our website linked also to the university's main web pages. And you can see that what we're focusing on a lot is the development of different teaching and learning materials under different themes and with different guest lectures and recordings like we have today. So for example, if you look under eco-pedagogy, you can see that we have a lecture that was held as part of the SDG4 seminar in our faculty last year, a yearly seminar that we have looking at sustainable development goal number 4. And you can also see that we provide different readings and teaching and learning materials with these as well. So we warmly welcome you to try them out, to explore them, and to join us for further events in this network. I'll now stop sharing and open up our PowerPoint to share, and then we will hear from our speaker. So, Paivi, would you like to introduce our speaker for today, please?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Yesit Ortega's talk today. My name is Päivi Ikkanen, and I work as a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Language and Communication Studies at the University of Jyväskylä. And it's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Ortega to all of you, both here in Ruusupuisto and online. Dr. Ortega completed his doctoral program in language and literacies education with a collaborative specialization in comparative international and development education at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. His general research interests are within decolonial critical ethnographic approaches to research, as it explores how globalization, capitalism, and neoliberalism influence educational policy decision-making processes and their effects on classroom practices and students' lived experiences. He advocates for other forms of knowledge creation and knowledge mobilization as a way to reach out to marginalized communities who cannot have easy access to information. So we welcome you, Yesit Ortega. The floor is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank everybody for the invitation today. Also, I am fascinated by the space today provided for this hybrid presentation.
Sure. Yeah. Just a minute. I just make sure it's shared on the Zoom.
You're sharing this. Hold on. I have to do this first. And then, hold on.
Yeah. Yes. And then just minimize this so that you're on the speaker. Thanks.
All right, again, it's a little bit of the technicalities. As you know, doing a hybrid work requires all of this work. So as I was saying, I would like to thank everybody for coming today, both online here on this little 360 camera, but also all of you who are here today and sharing the space, the open space for as a public lecturer. I'm really fascinated by these things happening over here. So what I will share for today with you is some of the work that I've been doing in the past few years at a research level, but also sharing sort of my knowledges and the knowledges that I have gained for the past 30 plus years of my life in different spaces. And I hope it resonates with some of you or not. And I also hope that the folks up there or anywhere here, can we at the end exchange some knowledges or questions or comments that you may want to have on the work that I will be sharing today. So A little bit about myself, just so everybody knows. Again, I said my name is Yacine Ortega, and then I was born and raised in Bogota, Colombia, in South America. And I have to say this in many spaces, not necessarily here, but other spaces, because a lot of people don't know where Colombia is. And when I say South America, they may think it's in South America, the United States. So it's important for me to mention these things out there in the public so people know where Colombia is, and that's where I was born. Then I also, part of my trajectory through life, I live in the United States in Chicago for 10 years or so, being an educator in dual language programs, teaching Spanish as well, teaching educators how to teach bilingual programs over there, curriculum design, and some other different things that I did in Chicago as well. And life brought me to go to Canada as well, in Toronto. That's where I've been living for the past 15 years of my life as well. I became a Canadian citizen over there, and I pursued my master's degree and my PhD in both, as Pybe was saying, in language and literacy education, but also in comparative international education. And that's what most of the work that I have done is with that lens, is the international lens, the global lens, so to speak. So on the agenda, we have roughly 2 hours, but I don't think I'm going to spend all the 2 hours doing this because I don't want to get you tired of this. But I might want to exchange, engage you with some of the ideas that I have to present today. And my presentation today is divided in different parts. So the first part is about the problem that I've seen and that I have seen throughout my work. But I'm also going to offer a possible solution. And I'm going to share with you just a few examples of the work that I have done as an educator and a researcher. And we're going to finish with what's beyond of the work that is being done so far. So we're going to start with the problem. Throughout the years that I have lived in different parts of the world, I have seen many things happening around the world in terms of what's going on, why the inequalities, why the difficulties, why the war, why so many things happening around the world. So I realized there is a problem. And you may feel identified or not with the problem, or you may have seen the problem, or you may be part of this problem as well, as I am presenting. Some of the problem is the idea of that we are living in a world right now. And some of the things that I've been presenting is about how we live, how we teach, and how we do research. So for many folks out there in the imaginary, there is this dichotomic or binary idea of those who are at the top and those who are at the bottom. And Foucault said it a long time ago, and Oviedo Freire from Ecuador and Bolivia has talked about this idea of those who are at the top. We'll see here Los de Arriba, or the top dogs, or so forth. Some others have talked about the oppressors. And then there is the other ones who are at the bottom, who are los de abajo, or some other people call it los nadies, or the underdogs, or some other call them the oppressed. And then we also see some of the other folks who are in the middle, los del medio, or the middle grounders as well. So as I'm going through this presentation and this triangle as well, you may want to start thinking about yourselves in, or your families, your relatives, the people that you work with. Where are you located in this triangle, so to speak, or in this binary mindset, and what has happened to you in terms of relationships, in terms of work and relations and research as well. That's what I wanted to say. But then it got me thinking, why is this that we and people out there in the planet see these triangles, see these type of dichotomic binaries out there in society? Where is this coming from? And there are many answers to this, but one of the many answers that I want to provide to you today, or the reasons why this dichotomic thinking is out there, is because of power. Then you may want to think, what do you mean by power? And then for Foucault, long time ago, power is not just about domination or control, but it is a productive force that creates and shapes our social realities, right? So power operates through different types of networks of institutions, practices, and discourses that shape the ways we think and the ways we behave and the ways how we relate to each other, etc., etc., right? And Foucault also emphasized that power is not necessarily one static thing or fixed, but is constantly shifting and negotiating through social interactions. So in this sense, power is not just something that some people have and some people do and others don't, but is distributed through society in complex and fluid ways. So what I'm going to be presenting in this first part of the talk is how power is seen out there in the planet, in the minds of people, in a dichotomic way, unlike what Foucault was saying. So first of all, at a society level, you may want to think, okay, so this is how power is. Some people are at the top, some people at the bottom. We see the upper class, the rich, those who has a lot of money. Then we have at the top, at the bottom of that, we have those who have less money, or the poor or the lower class. And you may want to think some other people who are in between all of that, like some high money, or some people are sort of emerging in terms of society or climbing up the ladder, so to speak. So similarly, when it comes to race, we might want to perceive that white bodies, white people are always at the top of the hierarchy and the rest are the bottom. So we see white people, or the people call it Caucasian, or the people Anglo-Saxon at the top, and at the bottom we have the indigenous black and people of color. That's how it is being called in the United States and Canada, or North America, to refer to this type of people in general. But we also want to make things like, in this pyramid, where are we located, and where and how are we holding that power in this pyramid? Similarly, in terms of gender or sex identities or gender identities as well, we also have this power also out there in the planet. And we also see the cisgender, the heteronormativity out there having the most power over the other one. And the other one at the bottom is typically usually the female body, or those who identify within the community of the two spirits, the LGBTQAI community, as well of those folks who feel identified that are non-binary or sexual, etc. And always we can see the male, or the male perceiving person, at the top. So you can imagine, in terms of sex and gender and identities, what are the bodies that are representing power in life and in society. Additionally, we have also in education and research, and I believe we are in the building of education, and we are in the field of education, most of my colleagues and the people I have lived with. So we have these dichotomical parts as well. So on one hand, we have those at the top, the teachers, and those at the bottom are the students. So a long time ago, Paulo Freire talked about the banking of education, meaning there are the teachers who are the ones who suppose have the power or the knowledge, and the students don't have knowledge or don't have power, and then I am just giving you and providing you this knowledge. By the same token, I am here standing here as if I were the person who has all the knowledge, and all of you who are sitting there or on the screen don't have power. But the way I see, obviously, is in a different way, in a more dynamic, non-fixed way. But this is in the pyramid that I'm showing you today, is that's how it is perceived for a long time. And still people still perceive that the teachers are the ones who have the knowledge, the students don't have the knowledge, therefore I'm here to provide you what you don't have. And in research, the same thing is happening as well. We are the researchers, those who have power. We study PhDs. We have projects out there funded by millions of dollars by institutions. And then on the other end, we have the research participants, the ones that we go there interviewing, we observe them in their classroom, we observe them in the field, and then we pull out, extract their knowledge, and we go back to our institutions and then enjoy the privilege of being a researcher by publishing in top-tier journals. So imagine all of these things are happening at an education and research level as well. When it comes to religion and faith, then we also have this dichotomic mindset, so to speak, in which we have seen some Christians, conservatives, fundamentalist believers at the top exercising power. And also this refers to the spaces or the context where you are. Anywhere in the planet, you will experience that power, or the non-power at the bottom, Judaism, Islam, other types of religions, some liberal ideas or liberal faith, atheism, pagan spiritualities, etc., etc., always relegated at the bottom of these power dynamics. one more or a couple more in these mindsets, we have this idea that the who has power here in this pyramid is the human with an anthropocentric mindset, in which we, the humans, have the power over nature and the power over animals as well, meaning that we go around, you know, not treating animals or nature with respect, or not understanding what animals and nature means to us, you know, disrespecting the water, disrespecting the plants, disrespecting the environment, throwing things in when we take walks, etc., throwing the garbage in the nature, because we believe that we are humans and we have more power over nature. And the last, but not necessarily the least, which is going to lead us to their talk today, is there is also this onto epistemological and geo or social political power as well that many of us are aware, and it is about the global north and the global south. So as you can see, for a long time, the global north is referred to those who have power, and the global south are those who have less power. However, for some, specifically the global north, are those nations of the world that have typically been characterized as with high level of economic and industrial power or development, and typically normally located at the north of the less industrialized nations. And I will detail this in a moment. And on the other end, we have the other one at the bottom, the global south, which for some have used this term, the global south, to avoid the problematic term of the third world that back in the day people used to call the third world, that, you know, Finland is a first world country, and then Indonesia or Philippines is a third world country. So to avoid that problematic, then somebody had been talking about, let's talk about the global south more as an alternative way of talking about the third world or the developing world as well. Others have talked about the global south is not necessarily that, but it's beyond that. Is it about the geographical aspects of where people are located? It is also about the economy. It is also about the racial or ethnic aspects of peoples. It is about the gender, as I said earlier, but it's also about the social. And how does this look in real life? Well, a few people, as you can see here in the photograph or in the figure there, we can see a distinct line in between the global north and the global south. And we see those in red are the typically connected with the global north. Although you can see Australia, it is in the south of the hemisphere, but it is also part of the global north. And then those in green are what typically we call them the global south. Other scholars have also discussed similar issues and comparing these ideas in another binary thing, which is called the center or the core versus the periphery, meaning that there are some countries that belong to the economic core or the social political core, and the other ones belong to the periphery. So imagine the United States, Canada, Australia, etc., belong to the core, and the rest of the world belong to the periphery. And then we see another figure that represents this mindset. And those that are in blue are those countries that are in the core of the social political spectrum. Those that are in, like, what is it, like purple, maybe? I think it's purple. Those that are in purple are in the semi-periphery. Those that are in red are in the periphery. And then we have the others that we don't know what that is. That may be a developing country, maybe it's struggling, maybe it's trying to figure things out. And we don't know. But what is clear here is how always when we talk about these issues, it's about those who are at the core and those who are at the periphery, meaning those who are at the top and those who are at the bottom as well. That's true. 40 years ago, I guess, or some years ago, I'm not good at mathematics, but already talk about in the world of languages and in the world of English language specifically, talks about the expanding circles of the language. And then they talk about the inner circle, the outer circle, and the expanding circle. So the inner circle refers to those countries that use English natively, quote unquote, that they use English as their home language. And then we have the outer circle are those who use English because their countries were colonized. And the expanding circle refers to those countries that are not using English, but they're using English as a second language or a foreign language or other type of international language as well. And here we see the actual map that represents that. The dark blue represents those in the inner circle. The blue one represents those in the, what is it? Forgot. Expander circle? Hold on, let me see. The outer circle, and then those ones in gray are the expanding circle, meaning those as English are just like a foreign language as well. So imagine these dichotomical ways of doing things as well, and in terms of language, but in spaces, you can also see that this is also happening. And I like to show these type of maps because that actually visually gets you an idea of that divide in between the north and the south. And I like presenting these maps of the places where I live. When I live in Chicago, you can see, and if you have, and if you are from Chicago, or if you have lived in Chicago, you have visited Chicago, you can see the difference, the actual lines of that make the divide between ones and the others. On the left hand, you will see the sort of yellowish and the green ones, which are the Hispanics and the African Americans, and the blue are the other ones, so you can see the divide. And then the right one, you see the Chicago core city, which you can see the African American and the Hispanic sort of at the bottom, and the other ones at the top. And then I was not surprised, because me being born and raised in Colombia, in South America, so I felt this difference, and I felt this divide and this dichotomy since I was born, right? And you can see that there in that graph, the clear divide in terms of social spectrum, so the low socioeconomic status at the bottom and the upper or higher socioeconomic at the top, meaning the north. And then I'm circling that to express and share with you that that's where I am speaking. That's my locus enunciation. This is where I'm coming from, my south. And when I speak my south, I refer where I'm coming from and my experiences in terms of race, in terms of language, in terms of other markers. That although I work in the UK right now, I live in North America for a long time, and now I'm here sharing these experiences in a country of the global north, yet I am still perceived as a person from the global south, no matter what I do, no matter what I say. In the imaginary of the folks who are out there, I'm still perceived as the other, from the other side of the line. And that line for Boaventura de Sousa Santos is what he has called the abyssal line. Some others have called it the abysmal line, because that's what perpetuates this abyss in between ones that have and the other ones that don't have. And you may know that this line is an invisible, quote unquote, invisible line that is drawn between the upper and distant realities that we live, but also is reflected in abyssal thinking. And this is a key aspect here in my presentation, because we don't see that line, but we know it exists. But it also refers to that distinction that we create in our daily lives in between the visible and invisible realms, because of these power dynamics that I showed earlier today. And the fact that we keep thinking in this way, this abyssal way, in this, there is one and then the other, that if we keep thinking this way, it reproduces this abyssal line, and it keeps reproducing these dichotomies throughout life. And I'll show you this this photograph that I found really interesting to this depict that abyssal line in between those who have and those who don't have, right? So I'm going to give you a few seconds to have a look at that, because that aerial view of society makes us think where you are in one or the other side of the line, or perhaps in between. We don't know yet. You know better. So That's sort of like my first part of the presentation. And before moving into the second part of the presentation, I'm going to take a minute for those who are on the screen to think these two questions. And for those who are here today, so I want you to take 2 minutes so I can drink some water. I wonder if this water is for me. Maybe it's not for me, but that's fine. To get some water. And in the meantime, I want you with your friend next to you and try to think of responding one this question, one or choose one of these questions for a moment and discuss it with your friend next to you. What can be done so those in power can really make the necessary change and transformation? Or you can think or discuss how can this abyssal line or this abyssal thinking be dismantled? So I'm going to give you 2 minutes. So please go ahead and talk to your friend next to you. We want this to be interactive. And those online, I also want you to think, or maybe you want to chat with another person. And I'll be right back. All right. Thank you very much for those who dare to talk to your friend next to you and try to make sense of the things that we're doing today, because I'm fearful that by the end, when I finish this, everybody's going to be gone and you will have the chance to actually exchange some of these ideas with your friends next to you. So the part number two is about the solution. I am one of those who think that there is a lot of talk about this is the problem, there's a problem, there's a problem. We do research, there's a problem, but we never show an actual solution of what things can be done. So I will share with you what I think could be one of the many possible solutions. And similar to the exercise that we just did, it's about thinking and asking questions and discussing questions with friends and people that we work with, right? So it's about exactly that, sitting down and think. And for that, it's about critical reflection of what we do, how we do it, and question everything that we are being faced and we are being related on a regular basis. So I encourage everybody who's here today and online as well, like to do this critical reflection or critical thinking and always asking questions and challenging the ways we think, the ways we produce things, the way we do research and teach, and et cetera. And this is an invitation to that. So that's the first part of the solution. And moving into that part of the solution is also about shifting the ways in which we see things. So imagine that we don't necessarily want to change the world because the world is what it is, but we can shift the way we see things. So imagine this is how you're seeing things right now, but it's just shifting the gaze to other things, right? Like paying attention to what we have never paid attention, right? Like I like this space today here because we can have a look at the different spaces, the different things that are here that we never pay attention. So this is an invitation that the NASA people, indigenous people of Colombia, who I learned from them when I went to Colombia. You know, I'm Colombian and I'm trying to reclaim my roots and what's taken away from colonization from the Spaniards. So in a sense, when I went there, the NASA people, the indigenous people, sort of, this is their way of thinking, saying we shouldn't be thinking the way we think before today's presentation, but more about how we can change or shift that cosmovision. And cosmovision refers to our worldview, our philosophical stance, so to speak. So our epistemology and ontology, the way how we do things, etc., in ways that makes us think of seeing, feeling, listening, and interpreting how we perceive the land and the spaces and the context that we are today and tomorrow and moving forward, and including those perceptions of risks and challenges and difficulties as well. So this is again the solution, because this is the second part about the solution, is how can we do things in a different ways that make more sense, and inviting all those feelings, those emotions that we never included before. And in order to do that, the work of Boaventura de Sousa Santos, the Portuguese scholar, sort of has developed a theory, I guess, around it, based on the struggles of the peoples from the global south, the communities, the women, the LGBTQ community, the campesinos, which is the laborers of the lands, the Afro descendants as well. So all of the things that have been done there, Buenaventura de Sonta Santos, we have to shift the gaze towards what is happening there and what we can learn from that experiences. So he thinks about developing a worldview that is in line with that worldview of the global South, because typically those worldviews challenge those dominant and hegemonic Western Eurocentric epistemologies that I explained earlier. And then he calls this epistemicide, meaning that when the Western world came to the American continent to extract knowledge and to extract resources, killed all of those knowledges from indigenous people. And he talks about this as epistemicide. So in other words, killing the knowledges of the ancestors. And then the second thing, looking through the lenses of epistemologies of the Far South, is about demanding a profound change in the ways knowledge is produced and validated. Some other folks that I have learned talked to in this university talk about legitimization. How can we demand that change and profound change in the way we see knowledge is produced and legitimize it as valid? Because in the pyramid that I showed you earlier, we always see that the knowledge of the North is the most valid, and the ones, the knowledge in the South is the less valid. Therefore, as researchers, and we were talking about yesterday, that we need to publish in top tier journals because that's the most valuable knowledge. And then if you produce a pamphlet or a fanzine, that's not knowledge. But Buenaventura de Sotos Santos invites us to say everything is knowledge, or everything is valid, and everything should be validated in terms of knowledge production, right? And he also talks about, with that mindset, we should start thinking about creating other alternative way of seeing this knowledge production, because he believes in the plurality of knowledges and the plurality of cultures. And as a result, there has to be some kind of resistance against those status quo within alternative politics of the global South. And with that in mind, he also talks about how can we, by shifting this gaze of shifting these ideas, we promote a more sustainable world that acknowledges the diverse knowledges of everybody's, from the North, from the South, from everywhere, as equal in what he calls the ecology of knowledges. So instead of seeing one at the top and one at the bottom, we should see all knowledges as valid. In other words, your grandmother's idea about cooking should be equally valid and legitimate at the knowledge that some of you we have created by doing our research. Not one more valid than the other. So that knowledge that your grandmother has about this specific recipe of creating something, that should be equally valid and should have the space and should have the window to be showcased here. So in other words, somebody like me being here today sharing this knowledge should have, your grandmother should have the space here also to share with you that ancient recipe with your families and relatives. And under the umbrella term of these epistemologies of the South as well, there are a few concepts that I wanted to share with you that I think is important. And one of the main important concepts that I borrow and that I'm being fascinated is the Arturo Escobar, which is a Colombian scholar as well. He talks about the pluriversal politics. And these pluriversal politics are about understanding that the politics of the world should be about the politics of understanding that there is a multiplicity or pluriversality of knowledges and different realities that we not necessarily acknowledge. So in other words, a pluriversal understanding of those systems that we never understood, and the understanding of the interconnection in all in capital letters, I didn't put it here, but all forms of lives, human and non-humans and beyond humans, to avoid this dualistic mindset. And also how we create a new world in which we produce and reproduce knowledges that to educate ourselves towards a living well with each other, in which in Latin America they call it el buen vivir. And here is el buen vivir. You may want to say indigenous communities in Colombia, Latin America, etc. They have talked about this for a while, and it is succinctly how can live well with each other regardless of the circumstances. In other words, my research, my teaching practice, how is this going to help us, all of us, not only a portion of us, but all of us, meaning the planet, the universe, etc., to live well with each other. And not living well with each other means to be successful or to have a lot of money, but more like we're happy and nurturing with our families. And bueno. Then the other concept that I wanted to share with you that is also from the umbrella term of the epistemologies of the South is another word that is in Spanish that is called sentipensar. And is how we individuals, educators, researchers, etc., tried as much as possible to find a balance in between the reason and the emotion, right? And sentir in Spanish means to sense or to feel, and pensar means to think. So in other words, sentipensar fosters a person who combines that love, that body, so we can actually reveal the truth from where we're coming from. And this is in search of a constant harmony and balance among humans and non-humans as well that we have already talked about. And then I have put it together in a framework for language education and language teaching in general that I have called it pluriversal language education, in which you can combine these ideas of el buen vivir, how can we live well with each other, but also how can we balance that emotional part and that rationality as well within a framework of pluriversal politics, meaning that we are all, there are many opportunities and various universes or multiple worlds out there that we can tap into, learn from, etc. I'm gonna take a little sip of water too. So the part number three, it's about the examples. So I have shown you this point, at this point, the problem, the situation, why is what happening, then a possible solution or a possible way of going about tackling or dismantling that problem or resisting that problem. So I'm gonna show you three key examples from my work in the past on how can this be done at a research level and a pedagogical level. So the case number one is in Colombia, in South America, and this case is related to my doctoral dissertation that I finished a few years ago in Colombia, and it looks at social justice and peace education in English language teaching in Colombia, right? And this ethnographic work happened in a high school in a marginalized community in Bogota. Remember the map that I showed you about Bogota in the South, where the poorest people live? That's where I engaged with these three teachers and their secondary school students. And then for me, from the frameworks that I just showed you, the epistemologies of the South, and me trying to shift that cosmovision, for me, it was important to go back home, go back to Colombia, and work with the teachers and work with the students who face similar circumstances in which I have lived all my life. So for me, it's about understanding, but also learning from them, but also trying to highlight and amplify what they've been doing for a while. So from the framework of social justice and peace building, this ethnographic work, so I spent 8 months with the teachers and the students while the teachers were trying to teach English as a foreign language through different types of social projects to try to problematize and challenge the problems that they have been facing, such as unemployment, poverty, teenage pregnancy, drug addiction, violence, conflict, all of those sorts of things. So the teachers at the core decided we need to do something about it. And I need to teach English, and I need to teach them the grammar. I need to teach them about the present and the past perfect, all of these things. But what a better way to teach this through different types of projects that challenge that neoliberal capitalism and global ideologies that the government is trying to promote through the teaching of English, meaning that the government, the Colombian government and any other governments for that matter, they send the message that you need to learn English because you want to be successful. And successful means get money, get out of the country, have a car and a house, a good paying job, and get lots of money. But for these teachers specifically, is the opposite. It's about how can we live well with each other? How can we support each other? How can we solve problems in our communities? And I'll show you a couple of examples. How can I teach English so we can learn about our own country and be proud of our country? And some of you might know that Finns like coffee a lot. So obviously Colombians, we created the coffee. Well, they didn't create it. We just, you know, we know that it's not necessarily from there, but Colombia is one of the best coffees in the world. So the teacher said, instead of focusing on how violent we are and all the problems, let's focus on how we're really good. And then the students prepare different types of projects about amplifying that and then being proud of being Colombian and the coffee. Other projects was about, for example, there is drug addiction, and most of the students in high school, once they finish the day, they go into the streets and do all sorts of things. And one of those is selling drugs or taking drugs or being violent around gangs and drugs and derated. So this specific group created a project to help and support students after school to engage in all sorts of sports, mainly football. So in between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., they will engage any type of students in football activities. So with the mind set of deterring the students to get into gangs and drug distribution and sort of those things. Another teacher decided to focus on their future lives and say, we're going to create projects that are going to help you be a better person, a better citizen in the future. So she did a little project with the students, and with some phrases, just started this project about my gifts and my strengths, who you are and what are you bringing to the conversation of helping and supporting your community. So she created this project, the project of life. And the project of life was about, let's imagine that it's a mission board, no, a vision board, or how do you see your life after graduation, and how do you see your life contributing to your community? And then some of the students created these beautiful projects about the hopes and dreams projects, in which they depicted they wanted to be doctors, nurses, community workers, because they wanted to contribute to their communities and support the healthcare system in Colombia. Well, that was the case number one. The case number two is in Canada, in adult education, English as a second language. I carry out, do ethnography work with a colleague of mine who is an adult ESL educator in Toronto, and she teaches immigrants and refugees and adults to try to get their certificate so they can actually be somebody. And then we use the framework of anti-Black racism. And we ask this question because during the pandemic, as some of you noticed, the marches of the Black Lives Matter. So we went to the marches in Toronto, and we were thinking, how can we translate all of this into the classroom and start a conversation with the students to talk about racism in general, but more specifically about anti-Black racism. And then we developed this dual ethnography work, in which we were meeting online. It was during the pandemic, so it was with meetings online. We call it coffee chats online. And we recorded videos about our conversations, about how she would go about teaching this her ESL class through the lenses of anti-Black racism, and encourage the students to talk about this. And it was not easy for her, because there was an emotional distress, and she thought a lot of trauma was triggered from the students, but also her own trauma, and obviously my own trauma of research and racism in the spaces that I have shared. So that's one of the drawbacks of this work, is that it creates a little bit of traumatic experiences for both the students and the researchers as well. And here I'm sharing a couple of slides of the work that she did online about helping the ESL students to go about these topics and creating debates about racism in Canada. She provided different resources like videos and readings to do with the students, and then she provided some guiding questions, and the students will go through the questions and try to answer those questions using the language that was being provided. And then this is she trying to come up with responses to the students about defending or not what racism means in Canada based on the work that they did, the readings and the videos and the news that they watched at that time as well. So this is her role as an English teacher, was to provide the language to discuss this in the classroom. The case number three is another work that I did in collaboration or in consultation. I want to say in consultation with a group of friends who created a collective of, I would say, revitalizing the Quechua language in general. And the way I put it here, Canada, Peru, and Latin America, is because it started before the pandemic as a collective. We would hang out at the University of Toronto and on the grounds doing picnics because we have a friend who's coming from Apurimac in Peru, a Quechua speaker, and she said, I would like to share my culture. I would like to share my language with people. And I said, what a great idea. Let's do something about it. And we created the spaces, and a lot of people came, and we were doing sort of like a little picnics, and she would teach us of the language, but also the culture around it. But then the pandemic came, and then we couldn't meet anymore in person. And then we decided to turn these engagements into Zoom. And it's so interesting to know, because at that time, when we were doing the picnics, there were like probably 10, 15, 20 people, and it would range around those lines. But then we did this online, and we did posters. We submitted posters through social media, and why not? And the first few online engagements, we have around 500 people, which was the maximum for Zoom at that time, from all around Latin America and the world, like Germany and some places from here in Europe as well, who wanted to know more about the Quechua language, because some of them, they say, oh yeah, I've been living in Germany for 15 years, and this is the first time I get the chance to actually, you know, learn a little bit about my culture and my language from my parents and my great-grandparents. So imagine that we were connected people in Europe, Latin America, all Latin America, and Canada as well, trying to go around learning and revitalizing the Quechua language through the frameworks of what I have called transcultura linguación, which means how we can put the culture at the center of the process. And I'm going to give you an example in a moment. So we did all of these online, and this helped inspire folks out there to learn more about the languages, but not only revitalizing the Quechua language, but people who were curious, I want to learn a little bit about that. Why not? So a couple of things that I wanted to show you is that the teacher was showing us some flashcards about the domestic animals. And then typically when you teach English, you teach them like the translation mode, like, oh, this is a dog and this is a cow, this is a cat. And then you do the translation into English or the other language, and that's pretty much it. However, the conversations didn't end up there. And then we ended up in almost an hour discussion about culture and how here animals, for their culture in Peru, they're part of the family. They're part of them. They don't see them as pets. Like, oh, that's my pet. I need to feed the pet. It's just more like we are part of the family. And they have specific names for cats and dogs and hens and everything like that. And even hens or cows, when they're being killed for food, they ask for permission, and they actually talk to them that, man, we're gonna kill you because we're gonna need some food. So, and then sort of asking permission. I found it really fascinating when they were sharing this experience about like there is a hen and we're gonna need to kill it because we need to eat. So they have a 2-minute discussion with the hen. You know, you gotta nurture our bodies, etc., etc. So, long and short is that this class, it was not only I'm gonna teach you about the meaning of these words, but it was a cultural experience to understand more in depth what it means to be in engagement with the animals. And similar things here related to the different useful phrases that the teacher was trying to help us out as well. And then you say listen, then you say look, he speaks, etc., etc., etc. And you can see here about the different feelings and emotions. So we again another 1 hour discussion about feelings and emotions and how feelings and emotions are important for the culture. And then we ended up talking about love and love relationships and how romantic relationships evolve within this particular community. So at the end of all these three examples that I gave you, one of the things that I came up with in my mind is about the ongoing solution is about centering the work that we do towards human relationships, towards our communities, towards creating meaningful projects that respond to social injustice in community, but also that asserts the colonial praxis. And the colonial praxis means to challenge and question all of those mindsets that I talked earlier today. I'm going to finish in the next few minutes about, yes, we know the problem, we know the possible solutions. I have shown you the possible examples based on my experience on how this solution is in light of the experiences and what's beyond that, what to do. That shouldn't be that enough. Then it got me thinking this beyond means about looking at us on a cosmologic level as well. And what do I mean is that instead of seeing that pyramid that I showed you earlier at the beginning, one's at the top and one at the bottom, it's trying to move us into a new, and I'm saying new in, with quotes because it's not that it's new, into a paradigm that is not static, into a paradigm that is not binary, but into a more that is flowing, not rigid, that it comes and it goes based on all the knowledges that we have, all the experiences that we have without the hierarchy I seen ideas. A universe of synergy and reciprocities where no hierarchies but different opinions to choose from are part of this living creature. As you can see on the one side, you have the static pyramid there. And on the right side, we see this moving, flowing idea or paradigm that I'm inviting us to move from. And where do we get all of this from? Well, our goal is to promote that balance in the universe by prioritizing the common good rather than the individual's ideas through what has been called a dialogue or a plurialogo de saberes, a plurialogo. I don't know how to translate that, like a dialogue, plurialogo. It's more like a plural dialogue of knowledges through ecology of knowledges, through the construction of interculturality and to the construction of critical thinking and critical social political praxis that counterbalances those mindsets that I showed you earlier. And ultimately, based on the work that I have done in the previous years, but also me trying to reclaim my roots. When I went to Colombia, the Chibcha culture in Colombia, which is where my parents and my great-grandparents were born, they have this word called Pukuikui, which means heart. But heart for the indigenous people in this particular context, it's about doing, behaving, and thinking with our hearts in mind. With the spirits, with the soul, with the mind, with our body, we are connected with that heart. So that's my invitation for you today, to move beyond that Eurocentric, Western, positivist, scientific paradigms, binary, etc., into a more humane one in which you look at that core, at that heart, as you can see there in the photo, that pukuikui, that help us move forward as society. And if we are educators, we are language teachers, where language teaching and research should strive for that social justice, equality, diversity, identity, affirmation, and the celebration of all languages and all cultures under these pluriversal laws of understanding that we are all beings in connection with other living and non-living creatures. and also recognizing that pluriversality of beings that can be done while promoting and highlighting and amplifying and celebrating the cultural and linguistic diversities by tapping into all those fonts of knowledges of those who are and have been at the margin of society for so long. So I have one extra slide for you for some research implications.
This research experiment brought ideas to continue pushing the boundaries on the way we do research and education. I encourage PhD students and researchers to explore different forms of research using different data collection methods by using arts, poetry, narratives, chat and emails, photo analysis, multilingual metavideo recall, and of course AI technology in different languages.
So I decided to use AI technology here to speak in behalf of me to tell you what the implications are in terms of research, because that's where we are moving right now in this world right now as we speak, ChatGPT and other technologies as well. And I know this university is already working on AI technology to help us. So instead of rejecting the AI technology, how can we accept and use and embrace? I guess I didn't want to use the word use. I want to use the word embrace AI technology as part of this cosmos that I've been explaining today. So how can we use AI technology and other forms of knowledges to move us forward as society? So that's it for me today. Thank you very much. I appreciate the work that everybody's doing today. Here are some key references of the work that I have presented today. I have Twitter, so if any of you are on Twitter and want to follow me, well, by all means, go ahead. I have an email as well that you can always ask questions at any time. I have a website, justiceforall.ca, if you want to deepen into a little bit more of that and a little bit of self-promotion. We have another webinar in a week from today that, you know, I'm using that the QR code if you want to sign up or register. And if not, then you can always go to that tinyurl.com/JYU2023. If you want to sign up for this webinar in which I will be sharing the space with Melodine about her racial landscapes and my ongoing work on cultural and linguistic landscapes in Belfast while recording the sounds of the city. So you want to know more about it, so go ahead and sign up and come. So that's it for me today. I wonder if there are questions, comments, or reflections that some of the folks here on the stage are, or the other ones on Zoom. So I'm going to unshare so I can actually see something.
Yeah,